Welcome to Green and Red, Scrappy Politics for Scrappy People, a regular podcast on radical, environmental and anti-capitalist politics, brought to you by Bob Bazanko and Scott Parkin.
Welcome to the Silky Smooth Sounds of the Green and Red podcast. I'm your co-host, Scott Parkin, in Berkeley, California. And as always, I am joined by
Bob Bazanko in Ohio.
And we have a return guest, Nolan Higdon, who is a political analyst, author, host of the Disinfo Detox, and is a lecturer at Merrill College and in the Department of Education at the University of California, Santa Cruz. Nolan is also a Project Censored judge and has published a new book via, through Project Censored, or is it through a different publisher? Yeah?
Yeah.
And so we're going to be talking about Nolan's new book, which is called MAGA. I always have problems merging words like this, MAGA Academy, How Corporatism Paved the Way for the Hostile Takeover of Higher Ed, where we're going to talk about Trump's war on higher ed today, but we're also going to be talking about the war on higher ed that had been going on for quite some time before that as well. So welcome to Green and Red, Nolan.
Hey, it's glad to be here again and glad to see all that's going on with the podcast. It's really exciting. I should say that, sorry, it's the book can be bought at Project Censored is what I meant to say.
Maybe we can just kick off with why you wrote the book and why did you title it MAGA Academy?
Yeah, I wrote, you know, the book, a lot of the ideas had kind of been floating around in my head long before Donald Trump was elected to a second term. A lot of what's in the book has basically come from my experience, research, talking to other academics. And it was well known, certainly by Trump's first term, but well before then, that there was something really wrong with higher education. It had not just been going in a bad direction for years. At that point, it was decades. And those of us who work on the inside know how the leaders of higher education tend to conceal bad policy, bad for students, bad for faculty, bad for the production of knowledge, in a lot of social justice rhetoric and positivism. And if you combat some of those bad policies, you're attacked for being opposed to those social justice agenda. But I thought the reason why I titled it MAGA Academy is Trump really came in and used a lot of the levers of power that we had been complaining about to redesign higher ed and kind of his own vision and put together what I call the MAGA Academy. But I point on the book, yeah, Trump was delivering on long-term conservative goals of transforming higher education, but the tools were there for him, thanks in large part to decades of mismanagement. And I have to say, a lot of it does come from the Democratic Party, which has been the party of education. And polls show that's how most higher ed faculty identify, are Democrats as well. And so I want to point out that we don't want to make the problems with higher education in 2026 an issue of just Donald Trump. It was decades in the making. And if we're going to fix it, we can't go back to where we were in, say, 2024.
I just retired from 30 plus years in the academy, a few years in a community college, then most of the time at a big state university. And so, as you just point out, I've seen this coming for a long time. And if you look at, like, SDS, actually, this was an issue before Vietnam, even. So it's been in the making. And I think that's important to understand because in a lot of ways, it coincides with the emergence of neoliberalism, this kind of current assault. Do you want to just go back to talk? And you can start it wherever you want. And because I think Obama and Rahm Emanuel are important, even though they didn't necessarily work at higher education levels in this. But I just go back and talk about how this kind of emerged, whether it could be in the 60s, 70s, whatever starting date you want to give it.
Yeah, and say what you want about what happened to the kind of 60s generation of college students after the 1960s. But for a moment in time there, while they were in higher education, what they did with their education, a lot of them tuition-free education, really scared the crap out of the establishment. Here were wealthy, privileged white kids in a lot of respects, and they're aligning with things like the civil rights movement and the women's rights movement, and they're connecting that to being opposed to things like the Vietnam War. And it really frightened the establishment. And I think it really showed the power of education in many ways, that people could make these kind of connections and explore these ideas. In the 1970s, there was a confluence of events to try and combat that exact type of America that had been created out of the 1960s. A lot of people in corporate America were sick of the government managing industry, that New Deal liberalism. And they finally got their shot in the 70s. And those confluence events are well known, the inflation crisis or so-called stagflation. You've got the oil, you've got the embarrassment of the United States with the Soviets supposedly moving in Afghanistan and what happens in Iran with the U.S. So there's a lot of embarrassment in the 1970s, and there had been a lot of ideas coming out of these corporate think tanks prior to the 1970s, the most famous of which is Lewis Powell's memo, which Lewis Powell's memo said, hey, corporations, we need to get together and start spending money just the working class does with these unions, and we need to use that collective power to push back against government, unionization. And part of their agenda was to spread skepticism about public institutions, and schools were a major one. And so in the 70s and 80s, you really start to get this notion that it's clear that the golden age of the United States, as it was defined in the 50s and 60s, and that was a very racist, sexist, colonial definition of the golden age, but nonetheless, that golden age, as it was defined, was really coming under threat. It was obvious to anyone. And one of the chosen scapegoats was higher ed, or faculty and teachers in general, that our teachers are not teaching well, so they're failing our students, then our students are failing the country, was how the notion went. And there was this new economic and political paradigm imagined, known as neoliberalism, to deal with these problems. And neoliberalism was based on the idea that public is wasteful and it's unaccountable. And if we run public institutions like corporations, they'll be more accountable, more efficient, we'll have less waste, less corruption, and we'll get better results. It was a big belief that globalization and technological innovation were the future. And so we need to gear our schools, particularly higher ed institutions, toward globalization and technological innovation. And we need to let industry lead that. That is, industry needs to lead those technological innovations. And so what you start to see was an attempt to break all unions, and in higher ed, particularly faculty unions. But faculty unions are pretty strong in higher ed. They had decades of really strong negotiating. And so one of the ways they started to undermine faculty unions was by refusing to replace tenure-track jobs with new tenured faculty. Instead, they'd replace them with what I call non-tenure or part-time. They have different names. It could be adjunct faculty, it could be adjunct professor, it could be lecturer. Some campuses now actually call them assistant professors, even though it's an adjunct. But basically,
professors is big now.
Is that right?
Yeah, clinical professors has become very popular in the last 10 years.
Yeah, so it's all these names for folks who basically get paid less. They're paid per class. If the class isn't there, they can be fired at will. They don't get benefits. They have no security. And they went from being about a third of the faculty, because they were supposed to be for emergency situations, right? If we assign all of our 100 classes and we need to add one, we don't have faculty to teach it, we'll call in this adjunct for a term. They became the faculty, though. They went from roughly about, like I said, 30% of the faculty in the 1960s and 70s to now about 70% of the faculty are the tenure part-time faculty. And they string together a living working on multiple campuses. So they're really more double time or triple time, not part-timers in that sense. But what was promised was, with the lack of tenured faculty, all the bureaucratic work that was needed on campus would be done by this new administration, which is a group of staff and managers who would start to manage the campus affairs so faculty wouldn't get buried in bureaucratic work. Of course, that didn't happen. We did get a lot of managers and staff, but still a lot of bureaucratic work. And part of that is because at the same time, neoliberalism is making cuts to education. It's also making cuts to the social safety net in all these governments. And it's important to remember that neoliberalism transcended basically both parties. It's at the state and federal levels. And so higher ed institutions started to adopt rhetoric that they were going to pick up all the things the state used to do. So we're going to do mental health counseling. We're going to deal with food insecurity. We're going to deal with housing insecurity, et cetera, et cetera. But they don't really have the budget to do it. So you have this really bloated bureaucracy that claims to do a lot of things, but does nothing really well. And teaching and production of knowledge are afterthoughts. And the campus survives off money. Without state money, where do they go? They go for private funds. And so a lot of institutions start to be led by people from corporate America whose goal is investments. That's why universities are invested in land, for example, or other countries or investment bonds. The goal of the higher up, like executive level administration, is to make the campus profitable, not necessarily to make the education quality any better or the student experience in terms of knowledge production any better. And that's what was neoliberalism created. We can get into how that affected learning in a negative way and the political environment it set up, but that's basically what emerged out of the 1970s.
And my next question was around, so we've seen where the university was being restructured to be run more like a corporation with non-teaching managers and things like that. And so you touched on how corporations also have put a lot of money into these campuses. I'm here in Berkeley, and the lots of the pharmaceutical industry and big corporations and stuff like that go to the business school and things like that and put money. Could you talk a little bit more about that, about how we've seen this huge investment of corporate money into the university?
Yeah, basically a lot of the research that needs to be done is guided by industry, because industry will give money to different labs, for example, in the pharmaceutical industry, to do research that for something that can be commercialized. But don't forget, the students are paying tuition and the state is paying some taxes as well. And this is really beneficial for corporate America. A lot of the R&D is put into the public sector, and the production of information is a dirty process. In private industry, if you fail at research, that's seen as bad. It's too costly. In the public, that's actually good. Failures can teach us something about other avenues of research we need to take. So the public takes on a lot of the burden of the research and the loss, and industry gets a lot of the commercial gains. But because industry are the ones that are giving money to a lot of these labs, for example, they dictate what type of research is going to be done. The idea of research for, say, the public good, it often takes a backseat to what can I make money off doing. And we've seen increasingly big tech in the Bay Area is a big part of that as well. They invest a lot of these schools, hospitals and medicine, of course, like big pharma is heavily involved. And it changes the point of the public. It's rather than serving the public, these institutions are serving commercial interests through research and knowledge production.
In Texas, it's a lot of fossil fuel industry investing in.
Yeah, the University of Houston started an energy institute about 10 years ago. And Texas A&M, much of the ag school is funded by like Monsanto and Cargill.
And then my other question is, like, when we're talking about this sort of neoliberal transformation of the university, we're talking mostly about public schools versus private schools. Is that right? Or is it applied to across the board?
The model has really been adopted across the board. It's produced this sense of class elitism, which we call the professional managerial class who manage these institutions. And across the board, they're outside experts who think they know how to run a university better than, say, the students or the faculty. And we've seen that sort of top-down hierarchy. It takes on different forms in public and private, but it's held on a belief system, because a lot of higher ed, whether it's private or public, believes in this neoliberal notion that the future of the country rests on having a well-educated public. And that means degree attainment in the neoliberal mind. But degree attainment is not the same thing as being educated. And so you have these folks with these degrees who want these six-figure salaries at the top of universities, whether it be private or public. But the people at the bottom tend to always, that is the faculty in most cases, tend to get underpaid and exploited in those systems. And so that's something we see across the board.
And the other thing that you touch on, which is something that I started out as a POPS grad student and we organized around this on campus, is we've seen this sort of transformation as of the student as consumer, right? And I'm wondering if you could just talk about that a little bit. And then I'm really interested in getting into like how student debt plays into this and how during Clinton and Biden and the Senate really developed that infrastructure.
Yeah, the student relationship with faculty has been dramatically transformed in the neoliberal era. The promise of kind of neoliberalism was, we don't need all those unions and all that manufacturing job. We can move that stuff overseas and everyone at home can be service workers. There's a big difference between if you're a service worker working at Starbucks than if you're a service worker working in the medical field. And it was really a hollowing out of the middle class. And it put a gun to the head of a lot of workers starting the 1990s that to succeed, you had to get a degree. Now, people in higher ed were excited about this because this meant more people in higher ed. But at the same time, it transformed the way that students think about education. It's no longer about the public good. It's supposed to be a ticket to the middle class, right? Bill Clinton used to have this aphorism he would always say on the campaign trail when he's running for president, which was, you have to learn so you can earn. Young people are basically told since they come out of the womb now that they need to prepare for college. They need to get good grades, good extracurriculars. They need to have good test scores. And there's a lot of pressure put on them to get to college. And look, some folks, they don't want to go to college. They'll end up in my class and tell me they didn't want to go to college. They felt obligated to do it. And so they're there for a job. And they come with the understanding that, hey, look, I paid tens of thousands of dollars. I might be $100,000 in debt when this is done, to get a ticket in the middle class. And like any other industry, the customer is always right. And so there's pressure on people who work within higher ed to give the customer what they want. And we narrowly define this as student success. I talk a lot in the book about the vapid bureaucratic language. And this is one of them where if you ask anybody on campus what student success means, they'll generally freeze because they're scared to admit that they don't have agreed upon definition. But at least in terms of how they calculate student success, it means passing classes. So you're a successful instructor if the majority of your students pass. If your Black students are not passing, you're a racist professor. These are the ways that the data is often read. So faculty know this. And especially if you're one of those non-tenure part-time faculty, you really can't take a hit of looking like you don't promote student success or, God forbid, you're racist in the classroom. And if students have problems with you because you have things like, I don't know, standards, that's going to get back to your chair and that's going to cause meetings. And now you're a troublemaker and the chair is already buried under enough labor and adjuncts are, there's millions of them out there. There's an easy one to replace you with who the students like. And this is known as the disengagement compact, where essentially students say, yeah, we won't give the faculty much trouble. We'll give you positive evals. In exchange, the faculty member says, yeah, I'll drop the expectations a little bit here and there and go easy on you. You'll pass. I'll get my paycheck. Everybody's happy. The incentives are really perverse in modern education. And the institution fosters it. One of the things I talk about in the book is it has a different name on campuses, but there is this idea of accommodations, which is meant to be in line with the Americans with Disability Act, essentially that all students deserve the support they need to succeed in the classroom. Something I believe in, had a lot of differently abled students use it and need it and succeed. But some of the data shows that a lot of wealthier school districts tend to get more accommodations for their students. And by the time they get to college, the population in college who has these accommodations vastly outpaces the general population. Like some colleges, like 40% of students have these accommodations, where it's closer to 5 to 7% in the general population. And a student at, I believe she's at Stanford, wrote an article about this, about how it's an open secret on campus that students game the system to get accommodations, to get things like single dorm rooms, or so they don't have to take notes during class, or so they don't have to attend class, or so they're allowed to miss deadlines, or they can get like open books on tests and all this kind of stuff. And it was, I read the article and I asked my students about it and I talk about it in the book and how first they were really defensive and they made the case like, look, people need accommodations. I said, no, I know that. I'm asking you, do you guys know of students who admit they don't need them and get them? And they were quite open with me that, yeah, this is an open secret on campus. Everyone does this. And I said, well, how do you feel about that? And they said, one of them said, society hasn't given us much, hasn't given us universal healthcare. This is like one of the things we can actually get from the system. But it's created this, the people in the accommodations office know it as well. They give these accommodations to students who ask for them, not because they think the students need it to succeed, but because they don't want to get sued for breaking the American Disabilities Act. And so we've had these, and I talk about these absurd accommodations in there where it's like, they need an extension on deadlines. I'm like, do they need more time? Can I give them more time before the deadline? No, they need an extension of deadline. So they have a deadline phobia is what you're telling me. It's those kinds of like absurd things, or that they need open books, open notes for tests. Well, a lot of students could ace tests with open books, open notes. That's not the point of the test. But there's those kinds of things that you start to see because the accommodations office also defines student success as students passing. So their goal is to get students to pass, not necessarily to learn.
I'm glad you brought that up because I was later on going to ask you about that. A DEI question, because these are very difficult to talk about on campus and I've been accused of being all kinds of things. But before that, one thing I noticed is, let's just call it the homogenization of education. When I started, and by the end, I'm a senior tenured professor, one of the few who would teach freshman classes. And I organized the class any way I wanted. Who cares, right? And when I started, I think that was the way people did it. You had a particular theme. Mine tended to be things like imperialism and the economy or whatever. Some people focused on things like civil rights or women's history. It doesn't matter, right? But what, over the years, including at big state universities, it's like this increased homogenization of the curriculum, where I had chairs talking about like rubrics and grading standards that would be like uniform across the board in the way you teach. And students would come in and complain like last semester, the professor did this. I'm the professor this semester. I think I have to confess, you should never do this in podcasting, right? I got surgery a few weeks, so I haven't looked at your book very closely. So maybe you covered this, maybe you didn't. But have you noticed anything like that, this kind of homogenization? And it's even more because both Scott and I have a lot of friends who teach community colleges, which they derisively, some of them refer to as grade 13. because they're told everything. Here are your books. Here are your lessons. It's like an elementary school, not a university or a college. Have you noticed that? Did that come up when you were looking at this?
Yeah, absolutely. And also, I'm a big defender of community college. I've taught in them as well.
That's where I got started. Yeah.
They're a great equalizer. Yeah. Some of the most just interesting and thoughtful students you come across in the community college, given the just diversity of backgrounds in every sense of the word. But yeah, no, there's a big move out here in California right now. For folks who don't know, we have a community college system. We have a CSU system and a UC system. And they're underway right now, homogenizing all the numbering systems for the classes. So for example, I would teach History 7 at a community college. It would be History 100 at the CSU. Now they're all going to be one number, one description, that homogeneity that you're talking about. They also want to define so-called student learning outcomes. They penalize professors who don't put them on their syllabus. The learning outcomes are going to be homogenized. And really, it's like this form of pedagogical Taylorism that serves kind of two purposes. One, they want to make it easier for the evaluations. If everybody's the same and everybody has the same boxes to check, it's really easy to determine whether or not they check the box. It's not about improving learning in any sense of the word. There's also, though, another, I think, pernicious aspect to this as well, which is there's a belief, particularly those of us in the social sciences and humanities, as being seen as, yeah, it could be like a fun elective thing, but it's a waste of time. It's not going to make you money. And the more of this kind of homogeneity of courses and course tracks, we start to see more and more of these classes being cut or curriculum being loosened to be replaced. And that's because they're not seen as marketable in that sense. But it's really, and I talk about this in the book, it's bad for our democracy. When we have a historical electorate, it doesn't understand the system, doesn't understand power dynamics, doesn't understand the economy. See, times up the basic things. And it really, what you're describing there, the real opportunity to, I think, advance that agenda forward came during COVID, because during COVID, you had a lot of, everybody had to move online, or most people did. And they had an opportunity to say that if you're going to teach online and get paid, you have to pass these online training courses. And these training courses were not about different tools and how you could use them or think about them. It was giving everyone a boilerplate explanation of how courses need to be set up. One module per week. You need to have this kind of readings assigned here, this many assignments. You need to grade your gradebook this way. Again, making it all a lot easier for the evaluators to go in there and check these things out. And we'd be remiss if we didn't also talk about this, though, in the context of AI. While all this stuff is being digitized, everything's being captured, all that data, all those moves, all those grading decisions, all those lectures, et cetera. And they're looking, they believe they can train models to teach classes without actual teachers based on what they're getting from this setup. Right now, for example, the homogeneity is not just on the courses and the descriptions and the way they're set up. Now it's actually on the font and style of writing. They're trying to use ADA requirements to say that all writing in the modules needs to be this certain way. For example, you can't underline something because students will think it's a hyperlink, different size font. All this labor faculty are doing without pay. They're being demanded to do this. And it's not, there's no real research to show that a one size fits all writing style actually solves any of the issues that the differently abled face. But this is a control mechanism. It goes back to my point that faculty fall for this stuff because they don't want to be seen as being opposed to differently abled students for good reason. But that's how they get right in the trap. They start doing this stuff that's against education, even with the best intentions.
Yeah. And in a sense, it's been weaponized against the workers, faculty, workers, people who are trying to do their job. My other question is, and in the book, and I also listened to another interview with you where you're talking about bias reports. And I know in Texas that the state of Texas is requiring professors to sign pledges or whatever not to indoctrinate students. And I'm wondering, like, I'm assuming this is a little bit of state by state based on whether you're a more conservative state with a dominant Republican Party versus one that's more with the Democrats. But, like, how much are we seeing that sort of anti-political indoctrination?
Yeah, and it's a really good example of the case I make in the book, that a lot of the tools that the right are using now in higher ed came from the left. A lot of this bias reporting came from neoliberals in higher ed who are saying, like, we don't want any anti-transgenderism. We want everybody to feel included. So if you have bias, report your instructor. That's now being used, like you point out, in places like Texas. Again, left-wing indoctrination in the classroom. And look, I think students should feel inclusive, but I do think there is a part of education that is uncomfortable. if you're doing education right, it is uncomfortable. You have to face things that you wholeheartedly believe. Even as an instructor to this day, my students come up with different viewpoints that make me feel uncomfortable because I'm trying to think of how it fits into what I've learned, what I've read. That's part of the process. But again, the human resources aspect of higher ed, which generally takes the human out of the resource, is trying to get rid of that in terms of what goes on in the classroom with this bias reporting. Also, it really creates a weird dynamic that I think undermines faculty in a lot of ways, that faculty are there to be reported and evaluated upon by their students. What expertise does that student have to call out bias? I'm not really clear on that. And also, I would argue there's bias in everything. So theoretically, we should all be reporting each other all the time for the different biases we all have in that respect. And this goes to evaluations too. And look, it's not just me being a privileged professor. I bring up this example. I went to the mechanic with my car, and when they wrote it out, he gave me a card and he said, "I'd really appreciate if you'd give me an evaluation on my work today." And I'm just like, what do I know about building a car? I don't know. It runs, so I think you did your job well. But it's just absurd, like all these evaluations, and did it with students, because not only is it not clear they have expertise in teaching, but also you don't have a lot of data. It's like, how often did this person come to class? Was this a student who did really well, came to class a lot? That's going to be a little more valid of a critique than someone who never showed up, never read emails, never listened. What am I supposed to do with that? And then they can be weaponized against faculty. I've seen it happen personally in my time working in the union, where they'll pull out one negative critique, even though all the other comments disagree with that critique, and use it against a faculty member in their evaluation to try and kick them out of the department. So I think that it's this idea of just bias reporting, evaluations, the constant data collection that's such a major part of neoliberalism. It creates unnecessary work and just creates opportunities to stop faculty from doing things like teaching or valuable research, because it undermines academic freedom. Even if that student is totally wrong and making it up, you can't really deal with that if you want to keep your job. And so maybe you button your lip about certain subjects because you don't want to get reported for bias. It's that chilling effect that undermines academic freedom.
They've done studies where women and non-white professors and women tend to get lower evaluations. The only time I would get negative feedback, it would be like, he hates America kind of shit, yeah. That kind of stuff. I want to go back because I think in a lot of ways, the elephant in the room is DEI, which the right wing has so brilliantly used in everything now. Everything's DEI. It's become like national security or terrorism, right? You can throw DEI on something.
Typical race theory. Yeah.
And this is where, as a lefty, I break ranks and get a lot of negative feedback from many colleagues because the right wing's use of it is abhorrent and scary. But DEI was used by liberals, I would say, and I think a way that kind of opened the door to all this. And you mentioned accommodations earlier, and I saw that where I have no problem with it. People would like, I never understood the beginning of the semester, they give you a form, you have the sign. It's this federal law. Why? I can't say no to this, right? But I would also have students make these complaints like that were just crazy. And when I started, the dean or the chair would essentially ignore, not necessarily ignore, but go through the, but whatever. As the years went on, they took this stuff more seriously. The dean would contact me or the chancellor would contact me. And it was just, to me, it was just intimidation. It was their way of saying, we know where you are. We know who you are. And I thought DEI, and this is where I really get the shit hits the fan, right? Title IX, I think, became a club as well. Laura Kipnis from Northwestern has written some really great stuff about Title IX and how it became weaponized to use against people you don't like. And it didn't have to be for anything, right? And so do you see that where this kind of comes out of the best of intentions, DEI? And I know several years ago, I'm sorry, I'm on a rant now, but this is what I've done my whole career. It gets me exercise, right? But several years ago, I would start having a lot of our students would be teaching at community colleges or applying for jobs and ask me for recommendations and so forth. And they would also say, they want a DEI statement with my application. Can you help me with that? It's like, no, I can't, because I never had to do that. And I have no fucking clue. Like, they want this like, when I teach, I don't even know what that means. I don't know what a rubric is. Have you noticed that DEI opened the doors to a lot of this right-wing current assault on it? Long-winded point.
Yeah, no, and I think I can speak to that. I want to just go back to one thing you said, though, and then I answer that on the accommodations, because I don't think I said this, and it's worth mentioning. The issue with accommodations, it's not just that students are getting passed for not doing the work. That's an issue that bothers me as someone who cares about education. But you mentioned the forms. We have to fill out these forms, update these forms, sign in. It seems like not a lot of work, because no single form is a lot of work. But all the different forms all together at all the different campuses, it's the list of work that really buries faculty. And it does threaten academic freedom, because especially now, a lot of them are demanding to be able to record lectures and record what goes on in the classroom. And one, that can be used later on to train AI to take your job, not that it'll do your job as effectively, but nonetheless. Those kinds of things. And I argue it creates a chilling effect in the classroom. I ask my students to wrestle with ideas, and I need them to speak on ideas and make mistakes so we can all learn together. And if they know they're being recorded, especially because me, I teach about ed tech surveillance, they're not gonna be able to do that. And so it hurts the learning process and creates a workload, is two other critiques. But your DEI question, I think the right-wing assault on DEI was partially enabled because they're speaking to something that people know in a way that is incorrectly defined. So most people who work in higher ed eye roll at a lot of the DEI stuff because they know it's not actually achieving diversity, equity, or inclusion. It's corporate rhetoric to back corporate policies. And so when the right criticized it, I think that's really popular for a lot of people who notice that in the workplace. But of course, a lot of folks on the right are doing that to get rid of things like African-American studies or African Americans in history books. And that's not what my critique of DEI is saying at all. I still think those things are critical to education and knowledge. My critique of DEI is basically not that we shouldn't have diversity, equity, and inclusion, but it's the method by which they claim they're going to achieve it through this corporate hierarchy. And I paint the story of neoliberalism says, yeah, the system is racist, it's sexist, it's heteronormative, it's ableist. If you can somehow make it through that system to 18 years old, we will give you the opportunity to get $100,000 in debt for the opportunity to possibly make it into the middle class. That's basically the DEI framework. And I pushed back and said, why not use things like, I don't know, reparations or childcare, things that could be in the immediate for folks beforehand. But of course, neoliberals are corporatists. That would necessitate taxing corporations and redistributing wealth. Now, there's obviously no part of that DEI plan doesn't really include any sort of advancement for white working class people. So the DEI framework is, sorry, you benefit from race. We're going to help out the people who haven't benefited from racist policies. No wonder those people go vote for the right wing. The liberal Democrats' suggestion is, yeah, we have nothing for you. You're already privileged. You're not suffering. For someone who's suffering, they're like, all right, I'll go with the friggin' maniac orange guy in the red hat, who at least it pretends to acknowledge my suffering. And the way this is achieved on campus, and you brought up the diversity statement, which I call a homogeneity statement, which is they want to weed out people who don't care about diversity. And I guess maybe there's some benefit to that. But it also weeds out people who don't think about diversity in corporate terms. So those who would push for things like reparations or argue that the system is racist. And there's no way if a system is racist, it's going to suddenly be not racist by changing people at the top. I call it the neoliberal plan is, well, if we diversify the professional managerial class, the benefits of that will trickle down to people who share that identity. It's just like trickle down economics. It's trickle down social justice and just trickle down economics. Trickle is the key word there. So the diversity statement, I think, weeds a lot of those folks out on campus. And then you end up with a very homogenized view of diversity, as you point out. You've said this. Many people have said this to me. I've said this. If you start to critique, are these DEI policies actually achieving DEI? It's like, it's the worst thing you can say in a college campus environment to ever challenge that. Immediately, they don't know what to do with you. So they place you in the right-wing box. You must be a racist white guy because you're daring to ask that question. Having said all that, you brought up the right-wing backlash. I talk about in the book, and this is where I get into my media studies angle, really how bad the COVID era was, but also in Trump's first term, for those who actually do care about diversity, equity, and inclusion. On college campuses, I know this, I've experienced this, and I've talked to other faculty and students who've experienced this. Faculty thought Trump was an aberration and that it was their goal to resist, and they could talk negatively about people who were sympathetic toward Trump or Trump supporters negatively. I was in a faculty meeting where they said things like, oh, I've got a Trumper in my class, I wish they would just drop. And I was like, didn't we get into education because we changed minds? Isn't that the whole thing? Does everybody come in here and leave here with the same ideology? That was not my experience as a student. And I think that posture was really bad because young people picked up on that and it was blah. It was nasty that these faculty are trying to indoctrinate us. And then during COVID, everyone was at home and got a peek behind the curtain in the classroom. And I'll say in defense of some folks that the classroom and schools, we do try ideas out and sometimes they're disasters and they don't work. But what was the problem was during COVID was it was broadcast to the world. So you had the Black woman who gave the talk mentioning how she dreams about killing white people. You had the safe spaces on campus, which looked just totally disorganized and ridiculous in some of these videos. You had the day with where whites were not going to be on campus. That looked really bad. You had things like the study that was basically like the Skokel affair. But these researchers did a bunch of studies that were ridiculous with social justice language, like investigating dog rape and things like that. And you had commentators like Joe Rogan with millions in his audience broadcasting this stuff daily. You had the Stanford language experiment. I think that was December of 2020, where they listed like all the words you weren't allowed to use anymore. And it was like this absurd list of words. And it was so laughable. Stanford took it down in a couple of months. But all that stuff, we laugh at it in some degree, but the right wing really saw how ridiculous that was. It made us all look really ridiculous. And I think that's why it was so easy to, in part, to steamroll faculty when Trump came back to office, because we were just like a lampoonable punching bag for a lot of pop culture because what had gone on in that time period. And don't forget, shortly thereafter, you have the Gaza protests, where the students are steamrolled by these campus administrators for doing what all the advertisements for the colleges said, right? We love the 1960s. We love when students take power in protests. Then students protest and they got steamrolled by police. And the right wing did a really good job of co-opting that to show how stupid young people were and young people support anti-Semitism and all that. And Trump just fed on all that in his second term to make the MAG Academy.
At the beginning, you mentioned corporatization. These are also important. We had a president who's been at UH for about 20 years now, and within months, we were butting heads. She and I was chairman of my department at the time. But her big thing as soon as she came in was branding. It was just so over the top. We need to brand the university. And everything was about logos and colors, and everybody on Friday is supposed to wear red. And what amazed me was, like, I became faculty because you have no boss. You can just basically, once you're tenured, especially, tell anybody to fuck off, right? And all of a sudden, I see all these faculty on Fridays wearing red shirts, right? And faculty, I don't know how to put the question here, but did you notice an increased compliance even among people who, if anybody in society should be, who gives a shit, it should be especially tenured faculty, right? But I saw this increasing compliance to the point where one woman was boasting to me one day that she was wearing rainbow tennis shoes. That was her way to say fuck you to Greg Abbott. Have you noticed that? And I don't know, like, even they, you don't, it's not a quantifiable thing, and everybody I know would deny it, right? But I just kept seeing this increasing fear and compliance. And like, I had way more trouble in my career with liberals than I ever did with the crazy right wingers. Scott remembers there used to be this economist on campus. He and I would debate all the time. Great guy, went out for beer. He would drink DDT for breakfast, right? But great guy. And he believed in academic discourse. And I just saw that just evaporating over time.
Yeah, I talk about that in the book. I call it the feckless faculty who put process over purpose. And I think it aligns nicely with what we were talking about a moment ago with DEI. A lot of these faculty really started drinking the corporate Kool-Aid that they were furthering the country towards social justice by doing this kind of like vapid virtue signaling. Around this time, you would have all the signature lines with all the different signs that they stand with Black Lives Matter, or they stand with Ukraine, or whatever it is. And they would have these, they really would talk this up in their classroom, right? That, yeah, learning this, this is like social justice, this is this, and we're transforming the world. It was a lot of sort of circle jerking in a big way. These faculty were high on their own supply in a lot of ways. But on campus, it works well. You wanted to signal that you were part of the in-group. It was a way to advance. The administration was putting money and creating positions around DEI, social justice. If you signaled that, there was an opportunity for career advancement. If you were a contrarian who questioned the utility of some of these things, you would get vicious pushback. I talked about in the book how one of the campuses I taught, the president of the college would send out announcements that we stood with Black Lives Matter in 2020. They sent out announcements that we stand with Ukraine in 2022. And then when Gaza hit, we started to get a lot more email chains where people had differing views on Gaza. Some Zionists were Israeli supporters. Some of our colleagues were very critical of Israel and what was going on in Gaza. And the campus made the decision that it was going to be a penalty to talk about any non-campus issues on the email. And some of these people are like scholars of the Middle East, right? So I'm like eating this up as just an interested person, seeing this discourse go back and forth. But the campus decided that was not part of academic discourse. And you had people getting punished for sending out emails about what was going on global events after they had set the standard with things like Black Lives Matter and Ukraine. Faculty, you could not get more than four or five faculty on campus to at least raise the issue, and there was no pushback. The faculty was, again, totally bought into the idea of we're with the Zionist vision, even though that was not the issue at hand. This was a freedom of speech, academic freedom issue. So I think so often what they see are like as the well intentions of the good cause, blind faculty to do stuff like that works totally against the profession in terms of advancing knowledge or effective teaching. And now it's gotten to the point where Governor Newsom in California has a rule that effectively outlaws critiquing Israel in the classroom, regardless of what grade level.
Different sector, but being in the nonprofit industrial complex, it's very similar path. Talking about Gaza, because you opened the book with an anecdote about dealing with a liberal administrator on Gaza. Did you get blowback for anything that happened during that time?
Only for raising about the email thread on one of the campuses. I got a lot of pushback from colleagues about that. I also got another pushback. So the opening of the book, I'm talking to an administrator because what happened was the protests or Gaza encampments that happened in the spring of 2020. And a lot of campuses moved their graduations online because they didn't want the students protesting. And over that summer, one of the systems I worked for changed the time, place, and manner rules, which is where you could protest and how you could protest. And effectively, they made it illegal. You had to go through this whole process to be able to do it. And you weren't allowed to make noise and all that. It effectively made it illegal. And so that's where I called that meeting. I called that meeting on behalf of faculty and students. And I was like, this is just straight up a violation of the First Amendment. And you guys did this without any faculty input. And I went in that meeting knowing I was probably going to lose. But at least for my own therapy, I wanted to do my best to try and bury these folks. But the excuse they kept using was like, look, we have all these reports of hate crimes against our Jewish students and they don't feel safe. And I took that back to the faculty and I said, we should push for this data. I want to see what this is. Are they conflating critiques of Israel with hate crimes? What is the actual content here? Because at this point, we had seen news stories. Remember, there was the woman on campus who said she was assaulted by Palestinian protesters. Turned out she walked by and there was a flag waving in the wind and it brushed up against her shoulder. That was the big...
Yeah. Was that a Brown? Somewhere like that? Somewhere in the Northeast?
I forget. Somewhere that should lose its credentials for entertaining. Right. But the faculty, no, were really resistant to me. They thought that was a bad strategy. It was questioning whether or not anti-Semitism was going on campus. I said, if they give us the data and they're right, we'll change our position. But we shouldn't just be taking their word for this. But that was an example where I couldn't even get faculty just to push for transparency on the rules, let alone push against them. And I opened up the book at that meeting on purpose because there's such a chilling effect, especially amongst liberals right now in the United States and Trump's second term. That whole thing was happening at the end of the Biden administration. That whole criteria of the crackdown on protests, the erasure of First Amendment
places like with Kathy Hochul and Gavin Newsom as governor.
Yeah. So these supposed rising liberal stars, the Trump resistance, are doing the very things that freak liberals out right now about Trumpism on college campuses. That's why I opened it up with that anecdote.
Yeah.
And the Trump administration, especially with students, and you bring this up in the book, but it's also been like for people who particularly follow movement media or political media, the Trump administration has really flipped and weaponized all of this stuff that has been built over the years against the anti-genocide Gaza protesters more than anything. Mahmoud Khalil and folks like that have been like really targeted both within the university then also outside as well.
Yeah. Again, a lot of the neoliberal mechanisms like about withholding funding, Trump has now used against these universities to change curriculum or get rid of certain faculty, ones particularly who are critical of Israel, or punish students. And all this is being done under the auspices of fighting anti-Semitism, which was the same kind of corporate stronghold that neoliberals use to supposedly be fighting racism. And that's the analogy I make in the book, is it's really all about this consolidation of power. And Trump is using the tools that already existed. Trump, is he really fighting anti-Semitism? Maybe he's stomping that out, but in the process, he's stomping out the entire university. He's making curriculum changes to get rid of women's studies departments, which have nothing to do with anti-Semitism in the grand scheme of things.
The actual legitimate anti-Semites in America are Trump's people, the ones who blow up synagogues and stuff like that.
Yeah, no, I think that's a fair critique I would agree with that. And this goes back to the Biden era, but the Biden era conflated critiques of the Israeli government with being anti-Semitic. That really plays well into the playbook of actual anti-Semites. They've always wanted to argue that the Israeli government is the same as all Jews. The Biden administration really made that argument for them.
something else you mentioned at the very beginning, how a lot of universities, maybe when I was an undergraduate in the 70s, was probably where I thought you were pretty strong. And I went to a small school, a liberal arts school, as an undergrad. And when I became faculty senate, was a kind of a joke by that time. And then you increasingly see the rise of these super regents, people like Bill Ackman or Robert Kraft. In Houston, it was Tillman Fertitta, who's now Trump's ambassador to Rome, right? How much has that kind of emergence of these billionaire trustees and regents exacerbated all of this? And faculty, I think in their minds, deluded themselves that they had power. And now they don't even do that.
They wear red t-shirts on Fridays.
Yeah.
They signal their allegiance.
Yeah.
No, I think that plays a major role. A lot of these positions are seen as stepping stones to power or positions of influence. And they're judged on basically how profitable their system is while they sit in those seats. The quality of education and all that doesn't matter. The thing they don't want is negative press within the system. So if you have students protesting, like the Occupy movement, when they pepper sprayed those kids, or the Gaza protests, that all looks bad for you in that position of privilege. And so stomping that out becomes the only mechanism or the only thing you really care about. It also changes the goals of the institution. That sort of larger ideological goal of creating a open space for multiple ideas and perspectives to exist and compete, if you will, on campus, that's stomped out for just basic careerism. We see the university, because we're from corporate America, as a stepping stone to the future workers of corporate America. And those ideological goals of making it for the public good are just simply non-existent in a lot of these places.
We're getting towards the end of our time. I don't know if Bob has anything else.
Yeah, I do, actually.
Okay. Why don't you go ahead? And then I have a wrap question.
I think one of the tenets of neoliberalism, or even before that, let's call it corporate liberalism, maybe even more appropriate, was that you needed a strong higher education system because that was a marker of your state's development, right? Good public education. And University of Texas is a global institution, right? Not just national, but global. It's one of the most best funded schools in America. And you needed to produce work engineers and professionals and be able to attract contracts from the NSC or Homeland Security or whatever, right? I was stunned. H a few years ago got a $50 million anonymous grant. I'm pretty sure it was Homeland Security, DHS, something like that, right? But at any rate, and you wanted your students in those states to get good educations. And I used to say when this began in Texas, these guys are really undermining their own class interests, because if you apply to an Ivy League school and you went to a public school in Texas, they're going to say, what the hell did he learn there? Right? I'm not so sure now. I'm convinced myself now that's intentional. They don't care. They will destroy public education. Their kids are going to private schools anyway, right? How much of this do you think is just kind of part of a kind of a larger neoliberal, or I don't even know what Trump is. I wouldn't call him neoliberal. Or is it just an intentional destruction, a class war against everybody who's not them?
I think it's intentionally done to destroy higher education. I think, again, back to where we started the conversation, that a well-educated public scares the hell out of people in power. One that understands how to collectively organize, how to put pressure on power, that's exactly what they don't want. And that's why they prefer faculty who are there teaching and focused on careerism, versus faculty who are going to ask these larger class questions like you're asking right there about the system. So I think it's intentional. This is anecdotal, but I'm in a lot of unions where we're looking at negotiations right now. The campuses are trying to replace faculty. Some campuses have already gotten rid of their languages with AI teachers. They really want to simplify education down to the nuts and bolts, multiple choice, check this box. None of the theoretical organizing, collectivism, larger ideological discussions. And I think that's on purpose. I think that's always been on purpose. I think particularly for the right, they've had a critique of higher education because it does create different cultural sensibilities of people who tend to vote Democrat, who tend to be in positions of power, and they don't like it. They don't like the ways in which higher ed's allowed to socialize so much of the citizenry. And so I think they see it as a threat to their way of life as well. But regardless, I think the ultimate goal is to get rid of higher education, dismantle it one piece at a time.
I think that also includes something with the student debt. When I graduated, I got loans at 1 or 2%, and within a decade, they're pretty much, they're minimal and paid off. Now, many people, and again, Scott and I know them, have $150,000 in student debt, and their wages as adjuncts or whatever are being garnished. So it's this intentional impoverishment, precarity.
Yeah. And you're less likely, I should say, to speak out at the workplace when you have that much debt over your head, especially if you have a child at home or a roof over the head or spouse or whatever it may be. And that was one of the freaky things that came out of the Gaza encampments. A year or two later, you have these students who participated with somewhere like Columbia, and they're saying, we're blacklisted. We can't get a job and I can't pay off this debt. That message resonates with young people that they don't want to be in that same position. That's how you create a more compliant workforce.
One thing we didn't touch on too much is tenure and the attack on tenure, which in Texas, they've introduced bills in the state legislature to do away with tenure, for example, which is another piece of them dismantling the university.
Yeah, tenure, it's often, I think, incorrectly lampooned as something that's used to create lazy, out-of-touch professors. But it has a distinct purpose. It protects the academic freedom of the faculty member in the classroom. That's why tenure is so important. And particularly when you have shared governance, you need faculty to be protected so they know they're not going to be targeted due to disagreeing with, say, management or whatever. The erasure of tenure, that's a way to stop all that. Also, if all these faculty are non-tenure part-time, they're spread along multiple campuses, they're less likely to participate in union work, less likely to participate in the academic senate. Couple years of that, some administrator says, hey, how about we just deal with the student's learning outcomes and the course descriptions, and you don't have to deal with that anymore because I know you don't have time. And it's a way of just taking it over. And I'm sure faculty eventually will have to give up things like that if we don't change the trajectory of tenure because they just don't have the time to do it.
Just last, this is more of a statement. And this has been like what I've done for almost 40 years now. The complicity that I see daily now from university administrators and deans and chair and everything else is just like it sinks to new lows every day. And this was not a group I ever thought that had any kind of personal courage or really even much dignity, but every day. And we did a great interview well over a year ago now with Ellen Schrecker, who said, and this is the very beginning, 2025, he said, this is worse than McCarthyism. And one of the key elements of McCarthyism, and she actually wrote a book on that called No Ivory Tower, was the active complicity of these institutions like education. And what you're seeing now is just that on steroids, and it's really chilling. There's a handful of professors who have lost their jobs for it, but the vast majority are just going along for the ride, and every now and then they engage in some kind of symbolic resistance or something like that. But anyway, I love what you've done as somebody who's dedicated his life to this and is now out of it. It's so important. I had not, people said, oh, you retired because of Texas. No, this has been my plan for a while. The timing couldn't have been better, but I just really appreciate it. And it's just unfortunate to become my Abe Lincoln story. But I grew up in a working class community. Neither of my parents ever went to college, and I became a professor. And I just don't think that's possible anymore. Most of the professors come from families of professionals. People like me who, and my perspective, are just, they're just not going to exist anymore, which is really sad. Thank you.
Yeah. And that's another thing too, is that these campuses make a lot of money off graduate degrees. They sell desperate working people graduate degrees for higher ed where they're not going to get jobs. Like 80% of tenure track jobs come from the same 20 universities.
Yeah. I actually kindly quit writing recommendations a few years back saying, look, I say in good conscience, I can't saddle you with $100 million debt because you're not going to get a job. You're just not.
Yeah,
I didn't do it that way, but you know what I mean. Yeah.
I did a study and I put it in the book too, where I interviewed non-tenure part-time faculty. And I said, would you recommend this academia to your students? And the answers were all no to F no to hell no. That was every answer.
Yeah, I didn't. I would just say, look, you know what you're getting into. And many of them, they didn't realize you're looking at six-figure debt easily. Many of them never thought of that. And when I tried to explain the job market, as you pointed out, if you're from Harvard or Yale, maybe, but... And I had students, and Scott was in the same classes. I had students at the University of Houston who were as good as anybody that the Ivy League was producing. And some of them are working and have done quite well and written books. But a lot of them are like adjuncting, where you have very mediocre people with elite credentials who are out there being featured in the pages of the New York Times or have a million subscribers on Substack. And I'm certainly not referring to Heather Cox Richardson.
Anyway, we can wrap it there. Nolan, you want to tell us where we can find the book? The book is Mag Academy.
It's MAG Academy is the best way to remember it. You can get a copy at projectcensored.org. If you buy there, I'm sharing some of the revenue with that nonprofit. You can also check it out on my Substack. So nolanhigdon.substack.com/magacademy, G Academy. So you can check it out there. Check out the Disinfo Detox podcast. Got a lot of election stuff coming up, and really appreciate you guys. Always a pleasure to talk to you guys, and the conversation just moves so fast.
Thanks.
It goes by quick.
Enjoy your summer break.
Yeah. Folks, we've been talking with Nolan Higdon. If you like what you're hearing, please check us out on Facebook, Instagram, Twitter, Blue Sky. Watching this on YouTube, hit the subscribe button. If you're listening to this on an audio platform, give us a rate and review. If you really like this, go to greenredpodcast.org, hit the support button, or become a patron at patreon.com/greenredpodcast. And everybody out there, make trouble and misbehave. That's what we all need to be doing right now. Until next time.